Welcome to Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone. Today we have Brian Kaplan, a professor of economics at George Mason University, blogger for EconLog, and one of the world's leading advocates of free immigration. He has an excellent new book, Open Borders, the Science and Ethics of Immigration. He wrote it with Zach Wienersmith, who did the cartoons. I really had a blast reading this. I can tell you, to be totally honest, I learned more on page 165. I learned more than I did studying in school for 5 years. Mr. Kaplan, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Great pleasure to be here. I wish I remember what was on page 165.
Okay, well, that is my incentive for everyone else to buy it, but it's where you basically say, you summarize utilitarian, egalitarian, libertarian, in one single page. So it's definitely worth the read. Mr. Kaplan, when you advocate for free market capitalism, what does that mean?
Free market capitalism. So we've got this idea of capitalism, which is basically all the countries where government doesn't run almost everything. And then free market capitalism is the version of capitalism where government does a lot less. Of course, it's a slogan. So as to where you want to draw the line at, if you want to call Hong Kong or Singapore to be free market capitalism, everything else be less, you could do it that way. Or you could say, let's draw the line at a higher point. And so there are no such countries on Earth right now. And for me, it's a slogan. And so it's as long as you're clear on exactly what you're saying, it doesn't much matter where you draw the line. But the idea of an economic system where you actually live up to the ideal of having a separation of economy and state, or you're somewhere in that ballpark, that's what I would have in mind.
And what is the moral difference between saying having the state run an industry and there being private enterprise? What if I vote for someone who can really give me a lot of benefits through the state?
So what's the moral difference between them? There are a few moral differences between them. Most obviously, if it's a government-owned industry, then people have to contribute to that industry whether they like it or not. So, for example, if I don't want to patronize Amazon, I just don't do it. If I don't want to patronize the university system of the state of Virginia, as long as I live in Virginia, I have to do it because it comes out of taxes. So that's one obvious moral difference, is the non-consensual nature of support for government. Unless you just want to say it counts as consent just to live within the borders of a country. Although, if that's your standard for consent, then you could go further and say, how about just, you didn't leave the planet, so you consented to whatever happened on Earth. Doesn't seem too good. In terms of other moral differences, of course, it also morally matters how good the consequences are. So I think there's a lot of evidence that the actual performance of private business is far superior to that of nonprofits in general, and government nonprofits in particular.
Sure. You wrote an article called The Anarcho-Capitalist Frequently Asked Questions. Are you an anarcho-capitalist, and why?
Right. So I am an anarcho-capitalist, but not the crazy kind. So the crazy kind is the person who says, if I push a button, everything will be great. We'll immediately transition, everything will be wonderful. Or alternately, someone who says, I don't care what happens. And I think those are both naive and silly views. However, the idea that it is not only logically possible, but it's feasible to have a world where what we think of as the basic functions of government are carried on by private industry, I think that makes a lot of sense. And the way that I usually think about it is just say, all right, Matt, let's start with the smallest government you can imagine. All right, now let's dial it down 5% more. Can you imagine that? Right, so traditionally, there's been an idea that government has to, at minimum, have a monopoly over police, courts, and the law. And if I meet someone who thinks that, I say, well, we're already below that because there's a lot of private police right now. In fact, there's more private security than there are police officers in the United States. There are a lot of private courts, so any kind of arbitration system, and that's a big deal. Right, and there's a lot of private law, so arbitrators often will not use the law of the government that they're under, but they make up their own rules. Right, or say credit card companies have their own set of rules, or insurance companies, when there's dispute between their clients, they have their own set of rules. So just to say, it's clearly not true that we need to have a monopoly over these things, because we don't have a monopoly, and almost no one is complaining about it. And I say, okay, so once we accept that we don't need a monopoly, and we don't have one, then could we have even less? And I have a long lecture where I go over ways that you can do less. And I think, you know, normally you can talk people down to a very low level, and then finally you're left with such a tiny role for government, you know, tiny, even compared to what people previously thought of as minimum. And there's the question of, can you take out the last pin and have the system remain? And I say, you know, ultimately the main problem is just that if people don't expect something to be stable, that destabilizes it. But on the other hand, if people expect it to be stable, that stabilizes it. So an analogy I like very much is, if you go back to Sweden in 1000 AD and propose democracy, and just say, you know, well, instead of, you know, I don't know, with Viking accent, I'll make the Viking accent like a modern Swedish accent. You know, instead of just having a Viking, a warlord here, why don't we go and all write down names for who we think should be the leader, and whoever gets the most names will be the leader, right? And imagine all the Vikings laughing your face and their horns of ale tipping over with delight as they, and when you say that, and they tell you, well, you know, that's a stupid, and obviously whoever's the strongest warlord will kill whoever wins, and they'll take over. It wouldn't make any difference. And 1000 AD, that's true. On the other hand, imagine going to the modern Swedish cabinet and someone says, you know, well, maybe if we don't win the next election, we should just murder our opponents. And in that case, people laugh at that idea. Right, and what has changed is just social expectations about what's normal. And I say that in a world where people are used to the idea of government running police, law, and the courts, then to try to privatize those would go up against this problem of it's going to be unstable because it's just totally different what people expect. On the other hand, if you imagine a world where people take this for granted, then I say it would be very stable. Right, and then there's the question of how can you go from one to the other? That's one of the hardest questions in social science. All we can say is Sweden went from Viking warlords to what they have today, right? It took a while, but similarly, I say we can go from a world of government to a world of free market anarchism, not overnight, not violently, but just by shrinking the state and getting people used to things until they take it for granted, and till the point where someone who says that he's going to use violence to establish his rule seems not like a bad man, but like a fool.
Excellent. Say that I am someone who just really only cares about the poor. I think the middle class are generally taken care of. The rich have their own thing, but I only care that poor people have opportunities in life, and no one is too poor to live or to live with dignity. Why should someone like me support free markets or capitalism?
Right. So let's go back to my book, Open Borders, because the heart of that book is saying that right now there's an enormous amount of totally avoidable poverty on Earth caused by government regulation. Because right now there are people who are so poor compared to almost anyone you see in the United States, and yet they're able-bodied. They're perfectly able to take care of themselves, and they could take care of a bunch of dependents as well. There's just one problem, and that is that it's illegal for them to move to a country where they can go and get a good job. So if you are a rural farmer in Mexico, if you could just get across the border of the U.S. and work on a U.S. farm, you could make probably five times as much money as you do back home in Mexico, but that is illegal. So I would say if you really care about the poor, you should first of all realize that most global poverty really is, or in the long run, caused by these immigration restrictions that have kept people who are able to take care of themselves from in a free market from doing so. So that's the first really big thing, is to realize that there is a big system of regulation that has locked enormous amounts of global poverty in place. And this is totally caused by government, right? Because there are jobs that might not seem very desirable to native-born Americans, but which are fantastic in the eyes of most people on Earth, and it's illegal for them to take those. In the same vein, I would say there's another very large body of regulations that is terrible for the poor, both domestically and internationally, and these are regulations that make it very expensive to build homes, right? So right now, the high wage areas of the country are places like New York, Bay Area, but you might say, why don't people in West Virginia just go and move there? And the answer is that it's so expensive to get a home there, so expensive to rent an apartment, that you actually lose more money in rent that you would make from the higher wages. Right now, again, why is that? You might just think this is just supply and demand, but it's totally not. There's been a lot of research on this. And what's going on is that the construction business would love to build an enormous amount of cheap housing. However, Government does not allow it. Government makes it very hard to get permission to build. There are a lot of restrictions on things like how high you can make your buildings, how much of your land you can use, right? And standard estimates say that if you get rid of these regulations, or really just dial this level of regulation in these desirable areas of the U.S. down to the normal level, that this would lead to a dramatic reduction in housing costs in desirable areas and a very large increase in total production of the country. So I actually have this thought experiment where I say, imagine we went and deregulated the housing industry. As a result, the housing supply doubled and the price of housing fell by 50%. What share of Americans would call this a disaster? Right? And I think actually, and most of my, when I did a survey, most people thought that most Americans would consider this a total disaster, even though this is a scenario where we've doubled the housing stock and it's half the price of what it used to be. So you think that people would be happy, and yet the general expectation that most people have and that I have is that people would try to find the dark lining in the silver cloud of a massive expansion of affordable housing, right? And, but again, if you care about the poor, then obviously the poor would benefit if they could get housing for half the cost of what they're currently paying. Not only could they just afford a bigger, nicer place, they wouldn't have to rent. Maybe even if you're homeless, you could afford to get a place as a result. But furthermore, it would be affordable to go and move into these higher wage areas of the U.S. and enjoy that. So those are the really big regulations that are terrible for the poor. And we can talk about others if you want. So obviously, there are some other things government does that at least seem like they're helpful for the poor. And I think it's worth pointing out that there are two very large bodies of regulation which have an enormous and bad effect for the poor. Just to get that on the table, you know, so regulation of immigration, regulation of housing, these are two things that are terrible for the truly poor. So if you're worried about them, these are at least two massive ways of deregulation that you should totally support.
Say that, all right, you've convinced me capitalism creates a bunch of stuff. When people are free, they're more free to make voluntary exchanges, which increases their overall satisfaction. But I care about inequality. Let's say I see some people that have so much, and I see some people that have so little. And if they get laid off, their life is just in shambles. If I only care about inequality, why should I consider something like free markets?
Right. Well, I mean, just to sound like a broken record, if you care about inequality, you should favor getting rid of immigration restrictions, because those trap really desperately poor people in really severe poverty while protecting people who are already living quite well. And then similarly with housing, right? If you care about inequality, you should want to make housing cheaper so that poor people can afford nicer homes and also can live in higher wage areas of the country. So that would be where I would start. I guess I would also, let's see. In terms of other things to consider, I would just ask, so what exactly is the complaint about inequality? Is it really inequality per se that's bothering you, or is it poverty? So it's also true that the best places on earth to be poor are the richest countries. So the poor in rich countries are a lot better off than the poor in poor countries. So if your real concern is just that some people have a low standard of living, then again, I would say that free market capitalism is really good for creating more wealth. If your concern is simply with inequality per se, then I would just say it's complicated. There's a bunch of things that government does that increases inequality. There's a bunch of things that government does that reduce inequality. And so, you know, minimum, if this were your concern, you should start with all the things government is doing that make inequality worse and join me in trying to get rid of those.
Sure. Another aspect is, say that I'm someone who just is so terrified of monopolies. A small percentage of wealthy people gaining so much power over an industry that the entire populace is left at their mercy. If I am just so terrified of private sector monopolies, why should I consider free market capitalism?
Right. So just to start, I mean, if you're afraid of monopoly, I would say that you really should compare public monopoly to private monopoly. And so there are a lot of cases where the government owns an industry and controls it. So many countries have government telephone monopolies. So most of Africa prior to cell phones had government telephone monopolies. And in large part as a result, hardly anyone in Africa had a phone because the government did a very poor job of running it. So of course, right now we have a system where government runs about 90% of the education system. So, and, you know, like if that sound, if 90, if one owner having 90% of the 90% of an industry counts as monopoly, I would think that the education would sound, just would count. Of course, the post office, government monopoly as well. Illegal to actually deliver first-class mail, even if everyone who's directly involved favors that. So minimum, I would just say to compare private and public sector monopoly and just be aware of both. But you know, the deeper thing I would say is that private sector monopoly, you know, is a problem if government has made competition illegal, which it often does, or at least if they hinder competition. And once again, so in the construction industry, it's a very often illegal to go and enter and try to compete against existing sellers of housing. So you've got that kind of thing going on. But on the other hand, I would say if it's just that a private business has succeeded because they've offered consumers a better deal than anyone else, then I would say this is actually nothing that makes sense to complain about. So when you think about Amazon, I am continually baffled that anyone is mad about Amazon. So I just say this is the best store that has ever existed in human history. By far, I don't even see how you could really argue it. It is an endless source of cheap, convenient products, right? And yet, people somehow manage to find something bad about it. There is the interesting puzzle, how can they have such a great market share and yet still be continuing to serve consumers so faithfully? You might think they would say, oh, we've won, we don't need to give you a good deal anymore, right? And this is often a fear about monopoly is, sure, they get to be number one by being good, but once they are number one, then they can become bad. I'd say, I mean, really what we see is that firms like this generally are always looking over their shoulder because they know that if they stop not only being good, but they have to keep trying to improve to stay ahead of whoever might catch up with them. So when you picture it, when you think of it that way, then you realize that private sector monopoly, where they just get it by making consumers happy, is not only not a problem, it actually is the source of many of the greatest things we have in our lives, right? And furthermore, now, something that I did not anticipate 30 years ago when I first started studying economics is that we would come to a world where there are numerous famous monopolies that give their product away for free. Google, this is a machine that simply provides all human knowledge of the universe, does it for free. You can search all you want endlessly for text, for pictures, videos, and what do they charge? Nothing, right? YouTube, similarly, you know, they charge nothing. Some of these are freemium where you get a fantastic product for free, and if you want an even more fantastic product, you pay a few dollars a month, and then there you have it. So this is what we generally see with private sector monopolies, is that they got there for a reason. Sometimes the reason is that they got the government to ban competition, but the ones that people are complaining about right now, it's almost entirely just that they deliver a great deal and people are amazingly ungrateful, right? So 30 years ago, I would have been surprised that you would see famous companies giving their product away for free, but I'd be even more surprised that people would be so angry at them. And even 10 years ago, I was thinking, all right, well, good. Google has finally knocked this idea that big business is bad out of the American public because it's just so obvious that it's great for them. But I was wrong, and it turns out that people can be angry about anything.
That was the first thing that came to mind when you said, what if we doubled housing and cut the price in half? I go, AOC would be so upset, you'd never hear the end of it. Why are some countries wealthy and some countries poor?
Well, there are a bunch of reasons, but I would say that in the long run, the biggest reason is economic policy. So there is a set of economic policies that are very helpful for economic growth. So these policies generally involve having a high degree of economic freedom, stable private property. So that is a big part of it, and especially doing this for a long time. So if Haiti went and got very free market policies today, they'd still be poor in a year because a lot of this is cumulative. Of course, also being very open to not just international trade, but international investment. International investment is not just money, it is also know-how, it's organization, it's management. So these are very important things, but there are a bunch of other factors that have to be that you really have to think about. So a lot of evidence that average national intelligence matters, and this does vary by country, and that's just a fact. Some of that is probably reverse causation, but probably some of it is not. Just location matters too. So being in the tropics seems bad for a bunch of reasons. You got tropical disease. You've got just hot temperature makes it hard to work in most occupations. There's a book about Singapore arguing, I think, pretty convincingly that air conditioning was very important for Singapore to develop and would have been hard without it. And then obviously, if you'd step back further, another really big fact is science and technology. So in the year 1 AD, you could have had totally free market policies, and yet they still probably would have been really poor compared to France today, because they wouldn't have, that'd be just having free market policies doesn't immediately give you science and technology. Over the long run, I would say that it probably does, but that too is complicated, and it does seem like you'll get a period of stagnation, which may have something to do with policy, but that's far from the only thing. And then finally, you start getting the ball of technology rolling again, right? So you've got that, and you know, a bunch of other things. So war obviously is really bad for economic development, so that's can really hold things back, especially if even when you have peace, people are worrying about that another war is going to break out. So there's that. And then there's just things like savings rates. So if people in your country blow through all their money really quickly, and you don't have, and that by itself is likely to retard your economic growth. You could just get international investors, and it would be very wise to make them feel very comfortable, but still seems like simply being in a different country tends to reduce the amount of investment you get. So it's important to get investment domestically. That really helps. So there's that. And you know, there's plenty of other things. So possibly religion makes some difference too. So what's the religion in your country? There's a long debate about whether it was really helpful to be Protestant versus Catholic. I think at this point, there's a lot of doubt that that matters, or at least matters anymore, but you've got that. And I mean, I guess I would say the honest answer is, name any factor and it probably matters somewhat, right? So people like to have really simple models, but in terms of, you know, like I often think in terms of, yes, right, but what could you do, well, you know, in terms of policy? And that's where I would say, in terms of policy, you want to have a very high economic degree of economic freedom, and you also want to have a peaceful foreign policy so that you are not getting your country destroyed in conflicts. Again, of course, there's like, well, isn't the best way to have peace to prevent war? It's like, maybe sometimes. A lot of times it's not. A lot of times preparing for war causes a war that wouldn't have happened otherwise because you terrify other countries. I always like to say that the Soviet Union got very safe when the Red Army collapsed, because the only reason they were in danger really was that the rest of the world was terrified of them, because their army was too scary.
Sure. What if I am someone who just cares about the cleanliness of the environment? Everything else is materialistic nonsense. I only care about having a clean place for me and my cat because I'm so scared of the environment, I'm not even having kids. Why should I support free market capitalism?
I guess if literally you only care about yourself and your cat, then maybe it would be good for the environment if all other human beings perished. Right, you know, so if by definition the environment, like a good environment, is whatever it's like without humans there, I would just say that seems like a very strange view. I doubt many more than a few people actually even hold that view. What I would say about someone who just says, look, I would like to enjoy a nice standard of living, but also to have nice environmental quality, that's what I would say there is that researchers have found something that's called the environmental Kuznets curve, and it comes down to this. When you're really poor, economic development seems to make the environment worse. And so just picture being in a small agricultural society, and then you start getting some industry. Normally what happens at first is that the environment gets worse. You get air pollution, you get water pollution. However, when the income in your society, income per person in your society gets to a moderate level, then what we see fairly reliably is that this reverses, and then the societies start to clean up. And then eventually you get to what is typical in the first world, where you have both a high standard of living and a clean environment. So, and it's called the environmental Kuznets curve because it's a curve. First, development makes the environment worse, then it stabilizes, and then further development makes the environment better. Essentially, once people can afford to make things clean, then they make things clean. All right, so that's the main story. So now I would also say that often measures of environmental quality people use are deliberately slanted to make modern society look bad, because they don't measure the filth of earlier societies. So for example, usually we don't, when we measure environmental quality, look at amount of horse manure anymore. But what did the internal combustion engine do? It cleaned the horse manure off the streets. So 100 years ago, 120 years ago, let's say, just to be safe, the streets of New York City would have been completely blanketed in horse manure, which is not just unsightly and malodorous. It also spreads disease through flies and all kinds of other disgusting things like that. And the internal combustion engine, this went and basically made the horse obsolete after time. And so it indirectly got all that horse manure off the street. Now, in modern measure of environmental quality, we just take for granted that we don't have horse manure everywhere. But if we were doing a broader measure, not of particular kinds of emissions, but of how does the air smell overall, how breathable is the air, right? Then we would see that capitalism and modern technology in combination have improved things a lot more than even that simple Kuznets curve would have you think.
If we were to embrace a pure system of free markets and capitalism, who would protect the workers?
So what I would say is there's no who that protects the workers, it's rather a what. It's competition, right? So right now, of course, most workers get very little protection from the government. Right, really? Yes. Yeah. So who protects Tom Cruise? You know, like who protects Tom Cruise? Right? But who protects lawyers? Right? So, you know, who protects engineers or computer programmers? For all these cases, there's some laws in the books, but they're so irrelevant to what the occupation is. So almost no computer programmer is working for anything remotely close to minimum wage. So minimum wage is not protecting him, right? And similarly, so if it were a matter of the computer programmer feels like things are not safe for the job, yes, you could go and call up OSHA and wait around and see what happens, or you could complain or just find another job. So even now, in practice, almost everyone just relies upon competition to take care of them. And, you know, and even when you complain to an employer about something, there's a tacit threat, which is if you don't deal with my complaint, then what? I'm going to call the government on you? Sometimes, more often it is, I will be a dissatisfied worker if you don't address my concerns. And then when I get in a good opportunity, I'm going to leave. And this is what most employers are worried about, is that their workers will be dissatisfied and will leave. And I would say the same principle goes for lower skilled workers as well, is that it is the competition that protects them. There are, of course, a lot of laws that would at least apply for lower skilled workers, like the minimum wage. Although there I would say that when you really study the economics, you realize that it's a lot more complicated than the usual view. Usual view just says that you're an oppressed worker and the government comes and helps you and then you're helped, the end, right? But almost every economist who has looked at this says it's more complicated than that, because if all you needed to give a low-skilled worker a good life was a $15 an hour minimum wage, why stop there? Why not 25? Why not 50? Why not 100? Right? And this, eventually almost everyone will say, all right, well, you made it $100 an hour for a fast food worker, then maybe the job would disappear. And that's a very reasonable thing to think. All right, but then, wait a second. Well, what makes you think that $100 minimum wage does cause unemployment, but a $15 per hour, $15 per hour minimum wage does not cause unemployment? And I have to say, I've never gotten any halfway decent answer to this, right? So similarly for a law that requires that you give all of your employees health care. This is something almost everyone likes, and yet this does not in any way mean that an individual worker gets health care, because it essentially just says that employers have to either give you health care or not hire you. And obviously they may very well to make the decision to not hire you, right? When people are thinking about hiring a nanny, then it's pretty obvious that if there's a bunch of regulations about the hiring of nannies, a lot of people say, forget it, I'm not gonna bother. But somehow they imagine that for businesses, they don't think this way. And again, as to why businesses would not be responsive to the cost of labor and the cost of regulation, I just can't imagine where anyone would get this idea. And finally, just to get a really good idea of how labor markets actually work for low-skilled workers. Right now, there are millions of workers that do not actually have legal protection in the United States because it is illegal for them to work at all. So illegal immigrants cannot legally be working in the United States at all. And yet, you find that when they go and get jobs, they are not paid 10 cents an hour. Right? Instead, even in the illegal market, you see that employers are concerned about competition. So if I'm employing some workers illegally, still, this does not mean the workers are slaves. This, they could go and work for another employer illegally. And employers have to go and consider this. Right? And to me, by the way, this is also very relevant to another very popular worker protection, is legal protection against discrimination. So there is an idea that without discrimination laws, employers would be discriminating left and right. And I say, well, if Think about this. Illegal immigrants are people against whom it is illegal not to discriminate. According to the law, you must treat illegal immigrants very differently from people that are legally allowed to work. Namely, you're not allowed to hire them at all. And yet, even though it is perfectly legal to discriminate against illegal immigrants, in fact, it's required, people are worried that employers won't do it. They're worried that if all you say is they're not protected, that employers will hire them anyway, right? So what's going on here? I think the answer is people realize employers are mainly in it for the money, and therefore, if the law simply said you can hire illegal immigrants if you want, but they can't, but they are not protected from discrimination, they realize that employers would still hire them, and that's why the law actually says you may not hire them. You will be punished if you hire them, because otherwise, they know that these market mechanisms, competition, would work, and in the absence of laws that prevented employers from hiring illegal immigrants, it would be really easy for illegal immigrants to get a job. And you know, even now, when there's a bunch of laws, still, illegal immigrants find employment because employers are willing to break the law to make money.
What is social desirability bias?
Ah, great question. Social desirability bias is one of the most important and well-validated ideas in all of psychology. It says that when the truth sounds bad, people lie. And often they get sucked up into their own lies so much that they start to believe completely nonsensical things. All right, so some of the most obvious examples of this are, if you ask people if they went to church, a higher share of people say they went than really did when we go and look at bodies that were there. If you ask people how much money they give to charity, people will claim to give more money to charity than they really do. If you ask them how much they drink, they claim to drink less than the actual sales of alcohol show that they do in fact drink, right? If you ask them things like, you know, are you a better than typical driver? More than half the population says that. If you ask people, you know, how kind are you compared to others? How generous, right? Then for all these things, we see that there is a gap between what sounds good and what really is happening. Or again, one of my favorite ones is if you ask people, if you were pregnant with a Down syndrome baby, would you abort? Most people say no. Yet we have numbers on the fraction of people who find themselves in that situation saying that a very large majority do, right? It's the difference between what sounds good and what people actually do in fact do, right? Now, this is a very general idea, and you can, and once you really appreciate it, you can see it almost everywhere. But in particular, I say you can see so much of this in politics. For example, you'll see in politics that people will say completely nonsensical things. Like, nothing's more important than education. I don't care what your ideological views are. This is an absurd statement. Food is more important than education. Obviously. Right? If you either have food or no education, or education, no food, which one are you going to choose? Right? Or when people say things like, it would be better for us to go to war than to lose 1 inch of territory. Oh, really? It's ridiculous. Who cares? 1 inch of territory is not very important, and the war would be terrible, right? And then, you know, and once again, you can obviously see that when people are talking about war, politicians make a bunch of statements that are cheered with great vigor by their people, saying, we will die before we surrender. And yet, what does every country do when they actually have to choose between death and surrender? They surrender. Yeah, so, you know, perhaps the most obvious case being in Imperial Japan, when their rhetoric of death and their glorification of death is off the charts, and yet a couple of nuclear bombs get dropped, and like, well, there's death, and I don't know, it's gonna be all right. So that's what we see, right? And I say that when you listen to the justifications that people give for a lot of government regulations, government ownership, when you actually listen, it really just does come down to social desirability bias, and you know, it's that people say what sounds good without really thinking about whether it will work well. And, so sometimes I think people are lying. I think more often it's just that people have heard the lie so much that they actually have internalized them. So things like, you know, the minimum wage is just great. It's just a way of helping workers. Like, it sounds good. Like, what about a million wage of $100 an hour? Wouldn't that have some bad effects? So you don't really favor that, do you? So then what makes you think that having a $15 minimum wage for $15 per hour minimum wage isn't bad, right? And same thing goes, you know, like with many complaints about immigration, things like if one American is harmed, it's like, tell me anything good that has ever happened that didn't harm one American.
Yeah.
Like Uber. Uber harmed many more than one Americans. You know, the mechanization of agriculture harmed many Americans. So what, we're not going to allow any kind of progress if there's one person who shares my citizenship who's harmed by it? Again, it sounds good. It's the kind of thing you say in a speech, but it's ridiculous.
I want to get into open borders, the science and ethics of immigration here. Now, I did some research, and Garrett Jones, who works at George Mason University, has written a response to your book saying incomes in the United States would fall as much as 40%. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders was on, oh gosh, I'm sorry, it just slipped me. I think Vox.com, and he said, this is actually a conspiracy by the Koch brothers to bring in low-paying jobs in order to stifle competition so wages can't go high enough. So I'm someone who just cares about poor Americans. I see poverty all around me. How can we take any more, for heaven's sake?
Right. So two things. All right, so there's the very silly Bernie Sanders argument, which, just to back up, so let me just explain how exactly it is that immigration increases the wealth of mankind. So the idea is that you have a lot of human talent trapped in poor countries, and if you move it to rich countries, virtually overnight, the workers don't just earn more money, but they produce a lot more. And they don't consume all the extra stuff they produce, instead they sell it to other people and then partake in the benefits. So when a Haitian moves from Haiti to Florida, they go and get a job at a restaurant, and suddenly they are producing much more value than they were back in Haiti because they are saving the time of people with much higher value. Or if a Mexican goes and works, moves from a farm in Mexico to a farm in the U.S., suddenly they are earning five times as much money because they're growing five times as much stuff as they did under American management on an American farm rather than under Mexican management on a Mexican farm. Right now, notice this is not the silly argument that more population equals more production. This is the sophisticated argument that when you move people from a low productivity area to a high productivity area, the production of the world goes up as a result, right? So this is the way that immigration increases wealth. Now, when economists have measured how much does the wealth go up by, the normal answers are enormously for two reasons. First of all, a lot of people want to move. By most estimates, a billion plus people want to move. And when they do move, their productivity increases enormously by a factor of, say, five. So if you move a whole lot of people and their productivity goes up by a lot, this means that the production of the world goes up by a whole lot. So a typical estimate would be something like you double the production of the world in a world of open borders. All right. Now, when people start worrying about this, so there's, you know, there is, of course, the story that no, production wouldn't really go up. There's something wrong with that. Now, Garrett Jones, actually, in his critique, he accepts that. And then he, and what he says is that, all right, so let's, you know, that math seems to work out, at least in a simple model, but the simple model is his, by the way, so it's not just any old simple model, it's his simple model. But then there's the question of the distribution of the gains. So what Garrett says is that we could imagine a world where everyone moves to the United States, production of the world doubles, but then he says that the people who are currently here would get a lot poorer, right? And why is this? Because he says that based on other estimates that there'd be very little inequality. And so as a result of having very little inequality, while the average would double, the Americans would find that they are getting a small increase over this doubling of the world average, right? But since they'd only be getting a little bit more than the world average, that would still be less than they're currently getting right now. Right now, Americans would probably be earning several times what the global average is. So suppose Americans are earning five times the global average. Garrett's argument is basically like, well, Americans afterwards would get basically like 10 or 20% more than twice the world average, right? Or the current world average, and that's less than what they're getting right now. So my reply to that is this goes against all of our experience with large increases in production in the past, and we have a bunch. So we have the Industrial Revolution, very large increase in production, and the gains did not primarily go to factory owners. The gains were very broadly spread, right? Similarly with vaccines, the gains didn't primarily go to people that manufacture vaccines or invent them. They go to all the people who didn't die. The internet, the gains didn't primarily go to computer programmers. Similarly, I say that it's not reasonable to think that almost all of the gains were actually, in Garrett's scenario, It is that more than 100% of the gains go to migrants. I say that is totally unprecedented. We've never seen anything like that before in human history for any large gain in production. So, and again, his story is literally that there'd be a doubling in production of the world, but more than 100% of the gain would go to the immigrants. I say that's just unprecedented, so it's a totally unreasonable prediction, but I do see where he's coming from. Now, Bernie Sanders, where he's coming from, it's unclear. He doesn't quite say that we should just forget about everyone else on Earth and I only care about Americans, right? So he's still enough of an old-line Marxist to feign being an internationalist, but it's more along the lines of it would be worse for them too because we'd be undermining the international labor movement or something like that. So, and for that, I would just say that if you really believed him, then you should be against technological progress as well. Because it's the same idea of you figure out a way to accomplish more with fewer people, and then what's going to happen to the poor workers, right? And again, this idea has a lot of appeal, except for the fact that it contradicts 200 years of human history, where technological progress has been awesome for average living standards. Although, of course, sometimes it is bad for individual workers in a particular affected industry. But you always have to remember you're not just a worker, you're also a consumer. So if there's a lot of progress in your industry, but every other industry is stagnant, that can indeed be bad for you. On the other hand, if there's progress in a bunch of industries, including yours, then obviously this has been a fantastic boon and every reason we should think this to be true in the future. You know, I mean, really what I said is, selfishly speaking, what you should want is open borders for every occupation except your own.
Yeah.
So for me, the best world would be where we have open borders, but we deport all the foreign-born professors. Right? That would be ideal for me, because then I would get all kinds of great stuff produced by people that are not professors, but there would be much less competition in my field, and so I would have more money to spend on a much better basket of goods. Right? So there is that. But when you put it that way, you realize, all right, but what about the deal where there's open borders for all occupations, including your own? And I say that that is, especially in the long run, a fantastic deal.
I wanted to get into the mindset of someone who's passionately in the closed borders position. And he says, can all 7 billion people on the planet just wander in and walk around the roads? Can they set up tents and sleep on my side of the street forever? In other words, at some point, we only have a scarce amount of resources, whether they're provided coercively by the state or not. If we have so many immigrants, heavens, how can we possibly take in all these people?
Right. So, I mean, totally fair question. What I would say is, if all 7 billion came today, it would be a complete disaster. However, all 7 billion are not going to come today. We have a lot of historical experience with how migration actually works. And the normal pattern is that if you open up immigration between two countries that previously didn't allow it, at first it's just a trickle. And then it gradually snowballs. And over the course of years and decades does become a large number. But in that case, it's fine because it gives industry plenty of time to build the new housing, create the new jobs. And, you know, like, is this a pipe dream? No, this is what happened to the United States a bunch of times. Right? So this, you know, so the United States, when it got independence, would have had about 1% of the current population that it has now. What happened was that partly there was natural population increase, but a lot of that is immigration. If 300 million people moved to the U.S. in 1789, that would have been a disaster, right? And people would be starving in the streets. However, when you do it over the course of centuries, you can multiply population 100-fold, and it's not only is it fine, it's awesome, right? And now, with, you know, for the question of, would this mean that people could sleep in tents and so on? There's no reason at all that you can still have vagrancy laws and other things like that. So, I mean, right now, of course, it's legal for anyone in the U.S. to move to New York City. There's a small amount of homelessness there, although it has very little to do with the fact that you can move there, and a lot more to do with policy of the New York City government. What I would say is that in terms of things like people sleeping on the streets, there's already a bunch of laws that are around to deal with that kind of thing. And if you're wondering, like, wouldn't people just move to the most desirable place? It all depends upon real estate costs. So reason why there's right now a lot of people want to live in New York City except for the cost of living. Right? Now, of course, if we had both open borders and heavy deregulation of housing, then there would just be a very large building boom. But even there is a limit to how fast you can build a whole lot of housing, but it's a lot faster than people think. Right? So we can see how much housing they're building in Texas where regulation's very light. right? And we could do a lot more than that if we really actually wanted to, right? And if demand was there, right? So, but anyway, so, you know, the many, like, you know, like, are there examples of this or how does this work? So, you know, my favorite example I talk about in the book is in 1902, the U.S. Supreme Court declared open borders with Puerto Rico, an area much poorer than the United States. At first, only a few thousand came, but then more came and more came. It snowballed. And now, about 100 years later, more than half of people of Puerto Rican descent live inside of the 50 United States. But there was never any big problem. There was never a big problem. This is a way that Puerto Ricans who did come, they were very seamlessly integrated. They found a much better life for themselves. And along the way, they made Puerto Rico basically the richest place in the entire Caribbean. There was a hurricane, so that throws off the comparison a little bit. But Puerto Rico was not a very rich part of the Caribbean when the U.S. took over, and now it's virtually the richest part. And so it's not that brain drain went and ruined it or anything like that. Instead, allowing that open border not only let a lot of people leave and make money, but also allow the people that were left behind to go and enjoy a lot of other benefits. And so it looks like it's been not only great for the leavers, but great for the stayers too.
Sure. I recently went to Mill Avenue, a place in Phoenix, Arizona, and I hadn't been there in like 10 years. And the first thing I noticed is that it went from like being like a an all white, all English speaking town to like basically now it's a lot of Indians are there and very few people speak English. One thing that
Indians from India.
Indians from India, correct. Yeah. Yes, thank you. So the first thing that hit me was, do I want this for the entire country? Of course, the libertarian in me says, I don't like something. I have a voluntary or violent way of trying to go about solving it, so I can just do anything I want. However, I did see the fear that is in a lot of people's minds when they say, my entire country's changing, the culture's changing. These people don't necessarily, we can't even speak the same language, let alone the same values. Do you think, how do you respond to the major cultural downside that might happen as a causal result of an open border policy?
So I'd be very surprised if a large area of Indians had many people that didn't speak English. I can believe that English isn't their first language, but you know, so literally they actually didn't speak English at all?
No, I'm sorry. They were not speaking English. I'm sure they all probably spoke English, but it was not the language they were speaking amongst each other.
Right. So, I mean, I would say that the first thing, huge difference between English not being the language you're currently speaking versus not speaking at all. So, cultural gap between someone with two languages, one of them being English, and someone who speaks only one language is in English. So between these two scenarios, I'd say these are night and day scenarios actually for purposes of assimilation and labor force participation and just being able to interact. So, in any case, in terms of language, this is something where there's good data on it. And it comes down to this. So people that arrive in the U.S. as adults not speaking English, they've never actually become really fluent, right, with much frequency, because learning a new language fluently when you're adult is hard. However, 100 years ago, their second-generation immigrants, their kids, learned to speak fluent English, and this remains totally true today. Right? Now, when would this cease to be true? I'd say that it would cease to be true if you get an enormous number of immigrants from a country where they all speak the same language, and they are also very geographically concentrated. On the other hand, if you get a lot of immigrants, but from a lot of different countries where they don't speak the same language, then again, English remains the focal language. And of course, around the world right now, English is already the focal language, to the point where you can be a tourist almost anywhere on Earth, and still very few countries do struggle as an English-speaking tourist, because you can almost always find some people that do speak it. So anyway, I would just say that this is something where especially market forces, but also just the desire for people to get a better life for themselves. I guess that's kind of a market force. But all of it is just cultural transmission mean that there's actually a very high level of linguistic assimilation. And I go further and just say that when you go and look at second generation immigrants, the degree of cultural assimilation is also very high. So I would just say, again, this is not the kind of thing that makes too much sense to worry about. See, when people worry about assimilation, usually what they do is they look at second-generation migrants and they find any differences between them and the native-born population. And they're never hard to find. And I say that's not a reasonable metric of assimilation. What you want to do is to create a continuum where you have, say, the average person in India is at 0, the average person in the U.S. is at 100, and then you go and say, where would you put second-generation immigrants from India on this 0 to 100 scale? And I'd say probably you put them in about somewhere between 80 and 90. So to me, that means we have 80 to 90% assimilation, which is fine, more than enough for almost any practical purpose. And I say, if you need more than that, then you're just being unreasonable. Right? And especially when you realize how much cultural change there is over time. So I think my parents are both in their 80s. How culturally comfortable do they feel in America right now? Not at all. And it's not because of migrants primarily, it's because young people that are descended from them are too different from them. Right? So they grew up in the 1930s and they got a certain way things were then. And then what happened is there were many parts of their culture that they failed to convince the younger generation were worthwhile. And so culture changed. Right? And I say this kind of cultural change is just the flip side of freedom. I have this slogan saying, you have no right to your culture. Why not? Because culture is other people. You know, my mom doesn't have any right to have her culture remain Catholic, because for that to be so, it would deprive me of my freedom of religion. Right? And once you can accept that it's okay for cultures to change over time without migration, then I don't see what this moderate change that you get from migration, or why that's special or would justify anything further. But again, you know, my reaction to people who complain about cultural change is always, well, maybe you're right, so why don't you sell your culture? Promote it. Right? Instead of complaining or trying to stack the deck by saying people who don't agree with you aren't allowed to be here, how about you try to convert people? Right? I mean, right now, of course, there are many countries on earth where there are repressive governments that are desperately trying to keep Western and especially American culture out. Right? So Saudi Arabia doesn't want to have American culture in there. Right? Iran does not want to have American culture. The Ayatollah had this great word, he called it West toxification. West toxification, these Western ideas, Western attitudes, Western movies, women wearing skirts, all this stuff. He says that's poison and it's coming in and we need to crush it. And I say there's a kernel of insight there, namely, if there's just free competition between cultures, Western culture generally does win. And this is going to be especially clear. People can actually leave repressive countries and come to a place where there's a free market in culture or something close to it. And so the Ayatollah can't do it, and can't really do anything about it.
Terrific. I definitely recommend reading the book. It addresses virtually all the primary rebuttals someone would have to open borders, whether they're a progressive, whether they're conservative, or whether they're a libertarian, such as myself. I got three more questions for you. They're all more or less the same thing. What is the most important thing you learned from the work of Jason Brennan?
Most important work I've learned from the work of Jason Brennan. I think actually probably the thing, his work that I've learned the most from is his Why Not Capitalism, which is a reply to Jerry Cohen's classic work, Why Not Socialism? And what's really neat that Jason does in the book is he just says, all right, look, we can imagine a society of totally cartoonishly nice, sweet people who still want to have capitalism, and we can imagine what that would be like. And he relies very heavily upon the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse TV show for kids, where he says, look, there's clearly a capitalist society, all the characters own stores and run businesses, but they're all really nice. And he says, and this is what's wrong with Jerry Cohen's book, is he talks about a society where everyone's super nice and they're socialist. And Jason says, look, really all the mileage is coming from the niceness and not from the difference of policy. And it's not true that nice people would necessarily want socialism, because in the same way that a really nice person might not want to co-author a paper with another person, they might want to write singly so they can express themselves in a undiluted fashion. So too, in a capitalist society, a really nice person might want to run their own business so they can do it their way, express their individuality. And so I think that's a really nice way of explaining it, right? He takes what But, you know, he first presents the Jerry Cohen argument, and he rephrases it in this very persuasive way of saying, would you want to be part of a camping group where everyone was buying and selling things for everyone else and people were acting all greedy? And Jason says, well, you know, I probably would want to be in a nicer camp, but it's the niceness that matters. But we could also have a nice society based upon free market principles. And in fact, he says that one will work better. Right. And of course, it's not very nice to make someone follow the rules of your group when they want to do their own thing.
What is the most important thing you learned from the work of Michael Humer?
Yeah, so for Michael Humer, I will actually go out really far and say there's a whole literature on whether you can teach a human being how to think, right, which is overall quite negative. But I would say if there were any hope that there were a thinker that could teach people how to think, that thinker would be Mike Hilmer, right? Because he doesn't just have positions on specific issues. He has a general algorithm for how to think about anything. And the algorithm is this. First of all, start with some premises that will be plausible to almost anyone. All right. And that means almost anyone, right? It's not just, sure, me and my five friends all agree on this. No, start with some premises that would be very broadly acceptable, where you don't need to first have a whole worldview before you can see the appeal of the premise, right? So that's step one. And then step two is try to construct an argument that where you reason very carefully from broadly accepted premises to a non-obvious conclusion, right? So that is the general method that he uses. And then I was also seeing, you know, a secondary method that he applies is to say, anytime that you think that you've got a very broadly acceptable premise, think really hard about counterexamples to that one and see whether there's any lessons you can learn. And one lesson that he gets out of this is any principle where you are, especially, you know, any ethical or political principle where you just say this, something is always true regardless of anything else, that principle is almost always wrong. I think of this as all one sentence moral and political theories are wrong. Right?
Yeah.
Right? And again, it comes down to someone, you know, so there's the libertarian one. Well, you should never initiate force against anyone else. Well, how about if you could steal a dime to save the earth? How about that? You still shouldn't steal the dime, right? Right, but it could also be everything should be equal. All right, well, should it be equal? What if half of mankind will die of starvation if we equalize everything? Should we still do that then? Right, so that kind of thing. Right, so anyway, if you go and read Mike's work, all of it does follow these general principles of thinking, which I have found to be tremendously helpful. And it's something that also you can apply out of sample. So it's one thing to say some general principles, then he gives you some examples, and then you just repeat his examples. But I will say that you can apply this Humerian method to new questions, and I often have, right? And I have used this to get rid of many of my ridiculous and dogmatic views, because, you know, often there was some philosophical principle that I held, and then I just thought, well, would this make sense to someone? Would this make, like, who does this make sense to? Like, well, this premise makes sense to like five people. Well, why do I even believe it? Is it actually all that obvious? And normally, like, no. I mean, I believe it because I got really excited when I was young about this, and I've been barking it out at other people ever since. Okay, well, so let's stop doing that and let's see, is there any principle, what principles would seem obvious to almost anyone who was not in the grip of some other ideology, right? And so, I mean, I've applied this to many other issues, and I think I've just gotten a lot of mileage out of it, just for personal growth and for understanding the world. So, for example, I don't think, like, until he actually reviewed my book, The Case Against Education, I don't think Mike Hilmer really wrote anything notable on education. But if you read the book, you'll see that it's very Hilmer influenced, because so much of the book is about trying to find premises about the education system that will make sense to almost anyone. Things like, if you could either get the learn the material in a class but not get an F in the class, or you could get an A but not learn the material, which would actually be more helpful for your career? This is something, you know, so Mike didn't teach me to ask that, but this is the kind of question that you start asking once you take Mike Hilmer's thought seriously. And it does lead very naturally to, yeah, well, most people would rather have the grade without the learning without the grade. And that, along with many other similar questions, are really the inspiration for the book. And yeah, the book also has a lot of research in it, but a great part of it is just trying to start with premises that would be plausible to someone who wasn't dogmatically convinced that every class you're taking is pouring skill into you.
And finally, thank you for going over time with me. What is the most important thing you learned from Ayn Rand?
Most important thing that I learned from Ayn Rand? Let's see. So I knew very little when I started reading her, so that makes it easier. Let's see. I think, you know, probably the most important thing that I learned from her is that what we think of as philosophical skepticism in a lot of different varieties is really just self-contradictory. So this idea of, like, the only thing we know is that we know nothing. It's like, wait a second, how do you know that? Right? Doesn't that statement just contradict itself? So, and, you know, she's very good at pointing out many other flaws like that, saying things like, you can't even know that you exist. It's like, well, if I don't exist, then how am I even listening to you? Right. She has many things along those lines where, these are, mostly what we would just call philosophical sophisms. But, and I'm not saying that she originated this, because your question was, what did I learn from her? There are other people who have made the same kind of argument, mm-hmm. but it was from her that I learned that there are many popular statements of what we call skeptical or nihilistic philosophy that really are just totally wrong. And that's been a big influence on me. In terms of inspiration, she has a lot of great poetry about the value of reason, but I would say that she was not actually that good at reasoning herself, and really because she just didn't know any empirical psychology. So, I don't think psychologists, for example, they talk about social desirability bias, all right, and they got a lot of evidence on it, and Rand was unaware of it, as far as I know. She might have some statements that indicated that she figured it out, but still, that's not nearly as good as actually documenting it. Or things like confirmation bias. One thing that you will not see much of in her, but which is fundamental to rationality, is anytime you have a view that makes sense, always ask yourself, what are the best reasons to think I'm wrong? And that's not a very Brandian question to ask. And so while it is a fundamental part of reason, and she had some great poetry about reason, but I'll call it inspiring. It's inspiring, but if you really want to be reasonable, you've got to learn a lot more than what's just in what she says. And in fact, in a way, do as she says, not as she does. So live a life of reason, but that requires that you learn a lot about the fundamental errors that human beings are prone to, and then try to root them out as best you can.
Oh, Mr. Kaplan, thank you so much for your time today. I want to finish with a quote from page 16 of The Science and Ethics of Immigration. If a foreigner wants to accept a job from a willing employer, what moral right does anyone have to stop them? Thank you for watching Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. And thank you, Mr. Kaplan, for joining me.
All right. It's a great pleasure. Thanks a lot.